talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Dr. Lori Marker, the founder and executive director of the Cheetah Conservation Fund, or CCF. Marker has worked with cheetahs since 1974, and she created the Cheetah Conservation Fund in 1990, moving to Namibia that year to develop a permanent conservation research center for the wild cheetah. And while the cheetah population has dropped some 90% over the last 100 years, Marker reports that the number of wild cheetah has risen in Namibia, which has the highest cheetah population of any country, accomplishing that increase through various strategies, including measures with community farmers and ranchers to help protect their livestock from being killed by cheetahs, which in turn prevented cheetahs from being killed by angry farmers and ranchers. In a wide-ranging conversation recorded yesterday with Marker, speaking from her base in Namibia, we also covered captive breeding programs that take place in the U.S., some of the distinctive qualities of cheetahs, including the cat's unique genetic characteristics, as well as how Marker views the future for these animals. I'll play back my conversation with Dr. Lori Marker in just a few minutes here on Talking Animals. First, we're going to hear a song, though violating fundamental policy on Talking Animals. It's not an animal song, but it is magical, and it's by Sharon Jones, the phenomenal R&B soul singer, who's at the center of Miss Sharon Jones, a documentary about her and her remarkable career and how, while preparing for a major tour, she receives a diagnosis of cancer. WNF is presenting a one-night-only screening of the film tonight at Tampa Picture Show. There are two showtimes, 7:30 and 9:30. Tickets are just $11, and I believe this is the movie's Florida premiere. Tickets and more information at WMNF.org or by calling 813-238-8001 and speaking with Miss Julie. Jones is an electrifying performer with a broad and fantastic catalog, and this is one of my favorite songs of hers. It's Sharon Jones now with How Do I Let a Good Man Down on Talking Animals.
Thank you.
That's Sharon Jones. The subject of the documentary, Miss Sharon Jones, at WNF is showing as a fundraiser tonight at 7:30 and 9:30 at Tampa Picture Show. Don't miss it. One night only. Like I say, I think it's a Florida premiere. Not shown anywhere else in the area that I know of. Cool opportunity. She's amazing. Film has gotten great, great reviews and great acclaim. So, right now, I'll play back the conversation all about cheetahs I recorded yesterday with Dr. Marker. She was speaking from Namibia, her base. This is Dr. Lori Marker, founder of the Cheetah Conservation Fund. On Talking Animals.
Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals, Dr. Marker.
Yeah, thank you very much. Nice to talk to you about animals, in particular cheetahs, I hope.
That's right. Well, yeah, in fact, the Lori Marker saga is characterized by a lifelong devotion to cheetahs and improving their lot and increasing their population and so on. But the earliest chapter of that saga looks kind of different from what we see at the moment, a renowned expert on cheetahs with a PhD presiding over an operation in Namibia. So let's trace that arc a bit. Things currently are kind of a far cry from growing up near L.A., which I believe you did. Tell me about those formative years and what role animals played.
I grew up out in a very rural area in the Southern California area, and I spent most of my childhood on the back of my horse. So animals have been a very big part of my life. I was a pony clubber and a 4-H'er, and my life was revolved around riding.
And was that throughout your childhood? Or?
Yeah, I started riding, I think, before I could walk, so they say, and the pictures show. I started riding first with donkeys, and then I had my own horses, and I still ride. I try to ride even now, daily. We've got horses out on our farm, and I go out and try riding every morning, and that's still a passion that I have, my horses.
And at the same time, I think, if I have this correct, you were sort of barely out of whippersnapper status. I think you were maybe 20 when you were working at an animal park in Oregon called Wildlife Safari. In some ways, that seems like a pivotal part relative to cheetahs, at least, of your career. Talk a little bit about Wildlife Safari and what you did there.
Yes, I started at the Wildlife Safari in my wildlife career, and I started in their veterinary clinic and animal nursery, where it was the first time I first came in contact with cheetahs. But my time there, growing up with horses, I spent a lot of time with veterinarians, and back in those days, they didn't really have a lot of vets, and so doing vet teching was really what I was, and spent my time working with a couple hundred different species of animals, so from bears to oodad and, yaks to zebras and cheetahs and monkeys, you name it, and I think I've taken care of it, so...
And how many years were you at Wildlife Safari?
I was there for about 16 years, and... So for quite some time, and yet my whole focus, even there and running the clinic and the nursery, was the cheetahs. And that's when I first got to know cheetahs. We were one of the few places in the world where cheetahs were found in a zoological setting. And the park was a free-range park, so it was 600 acres. And the cheetahs had their own section, and as well as lions having their own section, and then the antelope species roam freely. So it wasn't really a conventional zoo. And there we actually were very good at breeding rare and endangered species.
I, of course, want to get to that in a moment. Since that was clearly your real first exposure to cheetahs, what spoke to you about cheetahs? Because it seemed like that was the beginning of a lifelong love affair of sorts. What really got to you about cheetahs at that point?
I was just fascinated with them. They were, nobody knew anything about them until... As they came under my care, I tried to read everything I could, and I started writing to people around the world. And of course, back in those days, you wrote letters, and they'd go away, and you'd eventually get an answer back. And people would write back, and they'd say, well, we don't know very much about cheetahs. There aren't very many of them in captivity, and they don't breed well in captivity, and they don't live well in captivity. So, oh boy, if you find something out about them, let us know. And I guess that just point of curiosity, I was just fascinated. Here, the fastest land animal, and these beautiful, sleek, long-legged, spotted cats with eyes that were just absolutely incredible. Nobody knew anything about them, and that just launched me into a lifelong kind of love affair of wanting to know everything about the cheetah, and then going from that level to figure out how could we save this animal from at that point and going on today, near extinction.
Well, I want to, in fact, talk about that in just one second in terms of some of your work there at Wildlife Safari. But I'd be curious to know, because you sound, even now, filled with great passion about what immediately enchanted you. I'm curious to know, in what ways has your attraction to and passion for cheetahs changed? Obviously, it's remained steadfast at its core, but are there things now about the cheetah that you feel very strongly about or that enchant you that are different from those very early days at Wildlife Safari?
Oh, I'm still just fascinated by every single one that I see. And each one of them, although they all look the same, they're all so very, very, very different. And
So
I've learned so much about them inside and out. But still, the biggest problem, I think, that keeps me going on a daily basis is how we are going to keep them living out in the wild. And the amount of problems they have for their very survival, which are human-caused problems. And even though we know a lot about them, their biology saves them for future generations.
Yeah. Let me first let folks know who might just be tuning in. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Lori Marker, the founder and executive director of the Cheetah Conservation Fund. This conversation was recorded yesterday. We've already touched a little bit in passing on breeding programs. Describe how you launched and sort of cultivated the cheetah program at Wildlife Safari, which was obviously your first venture into that kind of work.
Well, I'm not sure if I necessarily launched it. I think maybe so. I started looking at our animals, and you started looking at animals which got along, and you put them together, and they started breeding, which was very, very rare because, as we found now, cheetahs have what we call mate choice. And so a lot of the work that we did then and has led into ongoing successes today within the zoological field. But still, zoos don't have a great success in breeding all of their individual animals. So for the cheetah, I always say working with cheetahs is thinking outside of boxes, square boxes, that the cheetah has just made me think, about everything that is not normal. And from that, just watching cheetah behavior, and we developed a very successful breeding program in North America and then started working with people throughout not only the United States, but through zoos worldwide. Tried to help share the information that I knew about cheetahs. A lot of it really revolved around having large spaces and having a number of animals that the cheetahs could have mate choice. So again, as a wildlife park, we were not a typical zoo. Today, the zoos in America now have off-exhibit breeding programs, which have become very successful. And so my years of working with cheetahs and are going here now into Africa and watching more about how they live in the wild, it's helped change how zoos today are housing their cheetahs and have developed a collaborative program for breeding of this rare species by getting people to just not think typically about having an animal in a zoo, but understanding that they are different, they're very unique, and they need very special care in order for them to live successfully in captivity.
And Dr. Marker, along those lines, maybe talk a little bit about the kind of more specific challenges of breeding cheetahs. I mean, you talked about the importance of open space and mate choice, but also there's some kind of unique genetic characteristics that are an important part of this.
Well, right. In the early 80s, our early research really revolved around understanding the fact that cheetahs lack genetic diversity. And this was very eye-opening for the conservation world. Instead of just looking at numbers of animals, to look at what their genes really look like. And the cheetah is a very unique species, and we've written kind of a conservation story on what happens when populations, genes are not that healthy. And we ended up finding reproductive abnormalities, which we today continue to monitor, having very abnormal sperm. From that of their genetic problems even today, we've now actually sequenced the cheetah's genome with our collaborators, Dr. Stephen O'Brien, who's the main geneticist on cheetahs that I've worked closely with for about 35 years. And from this, it has made us shown us that the genetics are a really important part of their overall long-term health. So it will affect the populations the long run, and that has made us realize how important it is to maximize all the diversity within the small genetic gene pool that's there. So we have recommendations for which animals should breed within zoos. Those are called species survival plans and management plans. But with that, those animals may or may not like each other, so you have to have multiple animals. At breeding facilities, they quite often now have have a number of animals where they're in and out of, so the animals, again, have this mate choice, and they're not just one-on-one, because oftentimes one-on-one cheetahs, you know, don't like that other animal that they're with, and therefore they're not going to breed with them. We also found a lot of kind of disease issues as well, that the cheetah is an animal that has kind of a high level of stress, and by running speeds of 70 miles an hour and out hunting, that kind of relieves their stress at the same time as they're feeding themselves and having, you know, the important help that they need in order to be living in the wild. And so we learned a lot about how to reduce those stressors by giving them exercise and using mechanical lures. And with that, that also gives them, you know, mental health as well, and that also assists them with their reproduction. So all those things have come together over a lot of years, and with that, a lot of studies that have gone on, and my studies over here in Africa, and so I've been over here now 26 years, in actually trying to find out more about what healthy animals look like to keep them healthy in the wild, but also to help share that information back with our colleagues in zoos throughout the world so that they can keep their populations of cheetahs healthy as well. Cheetahs in captivity are a backup population. There are only about 1,600 cheetahs living in captivity in the world. And I manage what's called the International Cheetah Stud Book, which is a registry of the zoological facilities that have cheetahs, which gives them then the background to figure out which animals should breed to which animals who are not related to each other. So from that, still from our side, I'm trying to overlay it with how cheetahs do live in the wild through our years of work in radio telemetry and following the cats in the wild to understand a lot more about how they're living out in the wild. And they've got huge home ranges. So a cheetah in Namibia would have a home range of average of about 1,500 square kilometers. And roughly that's about 800 square miles. So they're very, very large areas. And with that, that gives us a lot more understanding on how they can live back in captivity as well.
You touched on a number of things, some of which I'd like to try to follow up on. Some we may circle back to. But just one of the things, of course, that stuck out about the stresses that they experience that are helped relieved by running 70 miles an hour and some of the things. So I would think that would, even as you try to apply that to captive cheetahs, I mean, I would think that there's a certain inherent limitation on the space and the ability for them to engage in this sort of more natural behaviors that would, A, enable them typically to get to those kind of speeds when they're, you know, chasing down a prey, and so therefore to reduce the kind of stress that they would otherwise experience and then be able to reduce in the wild. In captive situations, how is that replicated?
Well, a lot of the recommendations are to have larger facilities for cheetahs and using things like mechanical lures. They're like a lure that a greyhound might run on or a coursing dog. These lures work quite well, and you can have a facility that is large enough to run a lure to run the cheetah. They're not going to go 70 miles an hour. The top speed of a lure might be 45 miles an hour, but it gives them the exercising ability, and so a lot of the zoos today are actually putting runs into their facility design when they have cheetahs. There are not all that many cheetahs necessarily in zoos, so many of the cheetahs are at these off-exhibit breeding areas like the Wildlife Safari or the San Diego Wild Animal Park, places like in Florida, or excuse me, in Texas, there's the Fossil Rim, there's the White Oak Conservation Center there in Florida, and the Smithsonian, the Wilds in Ohio. Each one of those are actually breeding areas, larger areas, where they have taken the animals and the very valuable breeding animals and put them off exhibit into very larger areas where they also have exercise. So that's a different way of actually managing the animals, where the animals oftentimes are in captivity or maybe older animals or animals that are overrepresented in the genetic bloodline. But a very big choice on how the zoos have gone about managing their populations for the betterment of the cheetah as a species.
So this brings me, I want to sort of talk numbers a little bit. You mentioned the 1,600 cheetahs in captivity. And so if I have this correct, and I think I got some of this from the Cheetah Conservation Fund, so I got to believe these are very good numbers, very reliable numbers. So if I have this correct, the cheetah population basically in ballpark figures has dropped from, say, 100,000 or so in the early 1990s to fewer than 7,000 today. I gather about half that number, about 3,500. wild cheetahs are in your area, in Namibia. Is that, do I have that right so far?
Well, that's sort of right. It was at the turn of the 1900s that there were about 100,000 cheetahs. And then that is declined by about 90% in the last 100 years. So there are, so there's less than 10,000 left throughout all of Africa. The last of the Asian cheetah are less than 100 left in Iran, where, yes, here in Namibia, when we set up our foundation here 26 years ago, to try to reverse the decline of the population. And there were about 2,500 cheetahs in the country at that point in time when I set up the foundation. And today we've about doubled, well, no, there's about maybe 3,500 to 4,000 cheetahs in Namibia today. So we've been able to stabilize the population. And from here in Namibia, we have also helped develop programs in many of the other cheetah range countries. But Namibia is special because we have still very large open spaces. Most of the cheetahs are found outside of protected areas on very large ranch lands that have an integrated system of wildlife on their lands. And then wildlife is, the livestock has been protected. So this allows the cheetahs to actually have large areas to live. Through most of their ranges, they're not found in protected areas. About almost 80% of the cheetahs left today in the world are not found in protected areas, which does cause a problem as land use changes in Africa do occur on a regular basis. And so much of our work really revolves around working with communities, with farmers, with, you know, ranchers, livestock farmers, and to look at reducing human-wildlife conflict and not allowing the cheetahs to catch their livestock so that the farmers don't have to go out and catch and kill cheetahs or other predators. So our work has been, has been very actively involved in this aspect, which is a problem for predators worldwide.
So it sounds like there's, at least in broad strokes, a twin effort that the Cheetah Conservation Fund is involved with when it comes to the number of cheetahs on the planet. So, because a moment ago we were talking about the different efforts among zoos and other similar facilities to engage in breeding and expand those numbers and try to reach as much genetic diversity in doing so as possible. But my question that I was going to ask then, and then we've now moved on to the wild cheetahs, so we'll take that separately. But with those efforts, do any of those cheetahs that are come out of those breeding programs, are they, do they ever end up in the wild themselves, or are those ones more earmarked to remain in zoos and other zoological and comparable settings?
Those animals are kept in zoos at this point, mm-hmm. Or breeding facilities. At this point in time, captive bred animals are not being used to restock the wild. Okay. The wild really, you know, needs to stabilize itself before it can have other animals brought in. Our mission here is to try to keep animals living in the wild, which is a lot easier than reintroducing them. And that's why working together with the livestock farming community and the government to try to maintain wild animals living in the wild.
Right, but do I follow you correctly that when you were describing sort of the initial efforts that began in Namibia there, that there was, I think you said 2,500 thereabouts, maybe 2,000, 2,500 wild cheetah, and now that number is 3,500 to 4,000. So
yes.
Am I right in thinking that in addition to protecting the cheetahs and trying to mediate the wildlife dispute with farmers, livestock, ranchers, et cetera, that you're also producing additional cheetahs as part of that effort?
Yes, but not in captivity. Here in Namibia, we do not breed animals in captivity. So these are growing just from wild moms being able to raise their wild cubs out on the land and
okay.
having people appreciate the fact that the cheetahs are living free.
So
we're not a captive breeding facility, not at all.
Right.
We're a research facility.
Right. Okay. So in Namibia, then, those numbers are rising, whether a lot or the rise that you've seen, that's because other things, other measures have been put in place to protect the cheetahs that were there, and so those cheetahs then could reproduce in nature, so their numbers have gotten bigger without any particular artificial or other interference or involvement by you guys, other than your making all those policies and procedures put in place and negotiating with farmers, livestock ranchers, and others to make sure that there's no reason for them to kill cheetahs that are a threat or seen as a threat to their livestock, for example. So is that's how the numbers, in other words,
right,
have grown there?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So there's really
but
two
with
separate...
The animals,
yeah.
So no, but so the animals in captivity become backup. So the whole thing is we're trying to maximize the genetic diversity. We want to make sure that there are healthy backup populations. Of course, some of our research has also been involved in looking at the possibilities of reintroduction of animals, because in some of the areas where cheetahs once were, there may be a possibility that we could, if the land stabilized and the prey numbers come up and you can reduce human-wildlife conflict, that there could be places where cheetahs could be reestablished in populations.
But at the moment, am I right in understanding, or at least thinking I understand, that, for example, the cheetah population, the San Diego Wildlife Park, or the ones back at the place that you know,
right,
you began all those years ago, Wildlife Safari and other places in Texas, some of those that you mentioned, Ohio. So right now at the moment, those two twains never meet. So in other words, those whatever's happening in those captive breeding programs with cheetahs really have no direct crossover with what we're talking about now that's going on in Namibia. Do I have that right?
That's correct,
okay.
Right now.
Okay. I want to spend some time discussing conservation. I mean, literally the word conservation. For starters, the word is right there in the name of your organization, Cheetah Conservation Fund. So let me ask you, what exactly does conservation mean to you?
What does cheetah conservation mean?
No, not necessarily cheetah conservation. Just what does conservation, just the word conservation, mean to you?
Well, in my mind, it revolves conserving ecosystems, conserving systems that function, and conserving biodiversity. So in conservation, we're trying to look at conserving how these systems actually work that actually allow everything to function, and everything functions around environmental and biodiversity life. So conservation is working with people, conservation is working with governments, conservation is working in education in many respects, I would say.
Yeah.
And, you know, from that, as a conservation scientist, my science revolves around having the information to be able to share that knowledge to the general public, to be able to be aware and understand how things work and what role we as people play in that whole system as well.
Part of the reason I ask is I find, and having done this show for many years, the term conservation gets bandied about pretty loosely and sometimes just plain co-opted by all kinds of entities who use it to cover less than glorious or ambitious activities or simply as a fundraising gambit. One that comes to mind just because it's in our neck of the woods here is the Elephant Conservation Center that's operated by Ringling, which, as far as I know, and I've been looking at it pretty closely for a lot of years, has nothing to do with conservation, really, especially when up until just a couple months ago when the circuses suspended using elephants in their shows. It was mostly a place to kind of restock their touring shows with elephants, and now many of them, I guess maybe all of them, that have been retired from those shows live there, and they're doing, I think, providing elephants for other circuses that do still use elephants in their shows. But, I mean, to me, I didn't see anything, and still haven't, and maybe I've missed something, but I've certainly been searching for this for a long time, anything that really had anything to do with conservation there, for example. And I do think there are, as we've already sort of touched on in a way, zoos and other places like that that use that term to gussy up what kind of often amounts to just breeding, buying, and selling animals as a commercial enterprise, or to keep their own commercial enterprise flourishing. So, I mean, that's, I guess, partly why I was very interested in discussing conservation, because I think it's a term that's become extremely elastic and really seems to mean a lot of things to a lot of people, and sometimes it's just being used in a way that doesn't necessarily bespeak some of the values that you talked about in terms of biodiversity and working with people and governments and education and some of those things. So have you found that kind of in your over the years of your career that there is some fairly loose use of the word conservation?
Yeah, probably so. And I see a lot of not action. So we're a very, conservation is an applied science as well, conservation science. And so, there's a lot of animals and our wildlife that we are losing, and people don't really know how to apply things. And so it does take a lot of work and a lot of networking to try to do conservation. Good conservation is, you know, is done only by a few. That's why there's only a few people out doing it. We need a lot of people and we need a lot of help in order to actually succeed in the work that we're doing. So I try to get everybody involved in whatever way they can. And you know, I don't disregard too much. Again, I'm over here in the middle of Africa, so we don't see the same kinds of things that you probably see over in the Western world. And just my, you know, small visits that I come over to the United States, it's a way different mindset for many people to understand what I do and you know, in a conservation setting.
So with that in mind and saying that you're always looking for people to assist, I mean, besides your own direct efforts, what are efforts that others at the Cheetah Conservation Fund do? Or if someone were listening to the show and said, hey, in one way or another, I'd like to support that. I've always been fascinated by the cheetah myself, and I'd like to help out in some way. What are some ways that people could take some steps in that direction?
Well, great. We always encourage people to, if they like cheetahs or they're interested in what we do, to learn more about what we do. First, it would be to go to our website, which is cheetah.org. We do have volunteer programs over here in Namibia. We have interns, and we work with a lot of different universities. So university students can, you know, even apply to work in the field of conservation with us. We have chapters throughout the United States who are supporters, spreading the word, awareness builders. I come into the country a couple times a year and I lecture at universities and, you know, try to get people to be much more aware about what's going on. We have a small CCF office there in Virginia, where from there we try to work with people throughout the United States to help get them to spread the word as well, going to, you know, whatever, you know, festivals or workshops to talk about the work that's going on in the wild to try to save cheetahs. And we've got a very integrated approach to our work over here. We work with you know, livestock guarding dogs. We work, give those to farmers. We spend a lot of our time going to farmers' organizations and meetings. We do a lot of training with communities here. So there's many different ways that people could get involved, but I would say the big thing is if people are interested, to please go to our website, cheetah.org, and learn more about some of our programs. Of course, we are a nonprofit organization, so we do need funds to do the work that we do, and so I always invite people to join us and become a active participant in conservation. And with that, then we can put more dogs out, we can teach more school children, and we can save more cheetahs.
And Dr. Marker, with that in mind, and obviously you've done a lot and have for a number of years, but to what extent do you think even now that the cheetah is either misunderstood or just not well understood as an animal, broadly speaking?
Well, I don't think people know much about the cheetah. They've heard the word. They know it's fast. They don't know that a cheetah isn't a leopard. So if people were to see a spotted skin, or they would see, you know, all these clothing that people wear, they're all leopards. Cheetahs are very, very vulnerable. They're very unique, being the fastest land animal. People need to know a little bit more about them. So I do think that there's a very a lot of lack of information and knowledge about them. People don't know that they are only found in, you know, fragmented areas of Africa. People are oftentimes shocked to hear that the cheetah is actually, you know, it's Africa's most endangered big cat, and they don't understand what that means. And when you think about those numbers, less than 10,000 is not very many individuals. You know, they don't know that it's the most unique of all the cats, that they're in their own genus. Many people don't know maybe what that means, but they're not like lions and tigers. They're very unique and separate from that. They are not an aggressive and dangerous animal, although they are a wild animal, but they would rather run away from anything than they would fight something. Sadly, there is an illegal wildlife trade going on with them today that we also spend our time trying to stop, and that's primarily up in the Middle East where that's going on. So just for people to know more about the fastest land animal, that it is just the most unique and amazing animal, and yet has a lot of special needs that are today, their survival is in humans' hands. So it's not outside of our hands. We actually can make a choice whether this species will be on Earth for future generations or not.
No, I agree that I think even as kind of a animal guy who's interested in all kinds of animals, I realized in preparing to speak to you that I knew very little really about the cheetah. Some of the specific things that you said are sort of singular about the animal, and so I'm just guessing that at least a lot of people might be in the same boat. So there is, as you've noted a couple times, a lot to learn. Just even, it's very, you know, well presented on at cheetah.org. And we're just in our final moment or so here, Dr. Marker. So I guess I'd like to look ahead a bit. We've talked about history and kind of what's been happening. And I recognize you don't have a crystal ball, but as we've established, you've been working with cheetahs for a very long time, and you're clearly an expert. What does the next 10 years or so look like to you for cheetahs and their population?
Well, I think that we only have another 10 years to maybe make it right or not make it right.
Yeah.
And that's why our organization, you know, has, you know, scale up plans. We know what we're doing. We've got, you know, long-term strategic ideas, but it's really revolving around working with the communities in Africa where the cheetahs are found and helping actually get a lot of people out of poverty. So a lot of our programs revolve around habitat restoration, looking at community livelihoods. You know, I often say to people when I talk, how many people do you know want to be a poor, starving farmer in the middle of Africa and then have a predator, you know, eat your livestock that might not be healthy? So we work with people getting their livestock healthier, to have wildlife on the land. Namibia is very famous for having conservancies. We've got a lot of wildlife. Looking at, you know, tourism, which is a huge benefit to Africa. And Namibia is one of the safest places there is in the world. So we're trying hard to actually make a home for the cheetah in Namibia. And with this, use our programs that have been very models for the cheetah and help other countries where the cheetah is found to scale up their program. So we work in areas like Botswana, in Kenya, Algeria, Niger, areas where throughout the cheetah range. And with that, we've got collaborators that we're working hard to help their programs grow so that we are hopefully looking at cheetahs in the African landscape in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, obviously you and your colleagues have been working very hard. What would you say at this point your level of optimism about the future of the cheetah is?
Oh, I'm probably a glass half full.
Okay.
I work very actively with communities, with the governments. The governments play a key role. And then much of that also is the support from our Western countries, the developing countries, to assist in the developed countries. But it's really going to be around working with the people and looking at helping people in Africa have better educations and looking at different livelihoods again. And, you know, we look at, with our habitat restoration program, we're trying to link that back into helping people get maybe biomass energy so that they could have electricity, and maybe they could have electricity that would allow them to have a refrigerator, that maybe they could keep some of their medicines for their livestock or their themselves as a human, or their cheese or their bread. There isn't a lot of electricity throughout most of Africa, and those are some of the tie-in issues that we look at. We look at trying to tie in different programs that would certify maybe crafts or things that are sold from these cheetah range countries and helping them develop things that they can sell, and then also certifying those as cheetah country products. So we're trying to do a lot of different livelihood development options as well, because a lot of it will revolve around economics. Again, I welcome people and I encourage people to come and visit Africa, come down to Namibia, again, one of the safest places there is in the world, and see our wildlife and meet our people, and be a part of this new development process that might keep all of Africa's wildlife alive for future generations.
Well, that seems like the perfect point at which we've been speaking with Dr. Lori Marker of the Cheetah Conservation Fund, the founder and the executive director of it. Again, the website is cheetah.org. Dr. Marker, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, and good luck in all those efforts.
Well, I look forward to talking with you again, and thank you for listening, and please, everyone, go to our website, cheetah.org.
Thanks again.
And my thanks again to Dr. Lori Epker. This is Talking Animals. It's time to step into the comedy corner. We're going to hear a piece by Mike Birbiglia, who's the writer, director, star of the new film Don't Think Twice, as well as a comedian. Here's part of a piece called Arctic Fox. It's a setup by Mike Birbiglia in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
I'm always in these hotels, and I always watch a lot of television. I always watch these nature documentaries. I always feel bad for the smaller animals, because I feel like I know more stuff than they do. Like, I feel like I'm at a bank heist and I'm the guy in the van watching on the monitor, and they're like, the Arctic fox has only one known predator, the polar bear. And I'm like, Arctic fox is a setup. Get out of there. Cracker, please, to Arctic fox. Cracker, please, to Arctic fox. Put down the salmon and walk out of the building. This year I got to go to Alaska to see, I saw a lot of these animals that I'd see my whole life, like on these shows, like, you know, puffins and brown bears and eagles and porpoises. And it was like seeing celebrities. It was really weird. It was like, I really enjoy your work. I liked your earlier work as a cub. And it's weird because there's a lot of bears in Alaska, and there's so many that they give you pamphlets just in case you get attacked by a bear, and they tell you to play dead, and that seems like a real gamble. There's like a bear clawing you in the head, and you gotta be like, yeah, I think this plan's working out. Sure, I'm getting clawed in the head now, but I gotta be thinking long term. Just a few more minutes. That's a lot of blood. Bear's like, he doesn't think I think he's dead, does he? Probably read the pamphlet. Then I found out the animal that kills the most humans per year, not even the bear, it's the hippo. I didn't even know hippos ate humans. I just thought they ate those little white marbles. I thought that was the point of Hungry Hungry Hippo. That hippos are marblevores. And it's so scary, you know, when you're in these places, because with the different bears, you got to know the different strategies. With brown bears, you got to play dead. And black bears, you got to run down a hill. And polar bears, you got to hand them sunglasses and a Coke. And it's like so, it's like school, you know, it's like bear school.
That was Mike Birbiglia with part of a piece called Arctic Fox. It's a setup taken from his album To Drink Mike. Now, on a wholly different note, I'm a longtime fan of the Tragically Hip, the amazing Canadian band whose singer-songwriter frontman Gord Downie was diagnosed in spring with an operable brain tumor. Nonetheless, the Hip mounted a tour of Canada recently, raising awareness and money for cancer research and treatment, and the tour culminated Saturday in their creative birthplace of Kingston in a powerful and poignant nearly three-hour show that was streamed live and watched by millions worldwide. I watched it, got a bit teary at times, and can't stop thinking about the show, about the Hip, and especially about Gord Downie. So I wanted to acknowledge all that on today's show, and I couldn't get away with another non-animal song after the Sharon Jones one. So here's Gus, the polar bear from Central Park, not the Tragically Hip's best song, but certainly their best animal song, and it hints at Downie's songwriting gifts, in that it ostensibly comments on Gus, a polar bear at the Central Park Zoo, that became infamous in the 90s for swimming in his pool for up to 12 hours a day and was deemed neurotic and depressed and bipolar and was the very first animal that was treated with Prozac. So anyway, I love Gord Downie and I love the Hip. Here's Gus, the polar bear from Central Park on Talking Animals.
What's troubling, Gus? You sound something to kill any. What's troubling, Gus? Is it
something to kill and eat. What's troubling girls? Said nothing goes quiet. Is that what's troubling you girls? The mere mention of the name used to be enough to make every bird stop singing. Is that what's troubling you girls? No one is a
That's the Tragically Hip exploring What's Troubling Gus, a polar bear from Central Park, in only a way that Gord Downie of the Hip could really do. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity rolling in the noon hour. It constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Meanwhile, as a prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. Right now, it's time for animal news and announcements. This came from the AP a few days ago, thanks to Sean Canan in our news department here at WNF. An elephant refuge says it will no longer be doing business in Florida. The Orlando Sentinel reports that the National Elephant Center filed notice of withdrawal this month with Florida's Division of Corporation. Disney's Animal Kingdom and zoos across the country helped fund the center, which started taking elephants in 2013. It was created to provide short-term and long-term care for elephants. Disney officials told the Associated Press on Friday they have no comment. Officials with the elephant group did not immediately respond to messages. It was reported that 3 of the 5 elephants sent to the nonprofit facility after it opened have died. Last November, the facility sent the remaining 2 elephants away. One returned to Animal Kingdom and the other went to the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens. Now, you probably over the summer have heard and read about this very disturbing story in which dead cats keep showing up on the Howard Franklin Bridge. It's a stomach-turning mystery for sure, because they end up on a part of the bridge where, of course, no cat could get to on his or her own. So, obviously, something very twisted and nefarious is going on. At this point, various entities and people have stepped forward to offer rewards, including Florida Voices for Animals, and again, offering a reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the culprits who dumped the cats on the Howard Franklin Bridge. There is another reward, substantial reward, by Meow Now, St. Petersburg founder Dan Hester. So these now amount to awards in four figures, mid-four figures, I would say, or thereabouts. You can, if you know anything about this, you can contact the St. Petersburg Police Department at 727-893-7780. Or to reach Florida Voices for Animals, you can do FVA online at yahoo.com. Hey, so Perfect Pets that we've had on the show, and we did a panel about dog sitters and dog care and various related things, is doing its own brick-and-mortar store opening this Saturday, 27th. That's going to be at the Forest Hills and Greater Carroll Road location, and you can find out more by visiting callperfectpets.com. The website is callperfectpets.com. Also coming up this weekend, there's another round of Drag Queen Bingo. This one is to benefit the homeless pets through animal-based charities. So that's it happening at Hamburger Mary's. Again, Sunday, bingo cards, raffle tickets go on sale approximately 5:15 p.m. And you can find out more by going to animalbasedcharities.org. Reservations are recommended. This does fill up fast, 813-241-6279. And there's only a few more days, actually, I guess through the balance of the month, that Animal Coalition of Tampa is offering its Fix One, Get One free deal. And this is for dogs only. And you can find out more by calling the clinic at 813-250-3900 or go to actampa.org. And had other things I want to get into, including Florida's invasion by the capybara, but we'll get into maybe some of that next week. Right now, it's time to play Name That Animal Tune. Let's see if you can name this one. We'll take those off the air and offline because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Watching and Beyond. It's Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Speak again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.